From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you. So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
In the sky, Lord, in the sky.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's band, the Salty Dogs? What'd y'all think? They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at their website, thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, we are calling Shakespeare in the South, where three well-known Southerners bring their own true bard stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock. And tonight's show is in partnership with the Arkansas Shakespeare Theater in Conway. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? What do y'all think about our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight's show is all about the comedies and tragedies of our writers' own personal lives as they recognize a little or a lot of Shakespeare in themselves, others, and even the South. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, best-selling author Trenton Lee Stewart grapples with high drama. And we'll end the night with the Oxford American Magazine publisher Warwick Sabin as he picks up the phone and begins a quest to find Billy. But let's start the night with award-winning playwright and writer Graham Gordy on stage as he finds family in a familiar Shakespeare character in Base Contagious Clouds.
In describing a friend, Ralph Waldo Emerson said he did not wait for a contest. He conquered whether he stood or walked or sat. There are people who enter our lives and alter us forever. Most of us stumble through our days, though some of us are lucky enough to see someone walking upright and we say, there, that's how it's done. We witness their beauty, and whether we follow in their footsteps or not, we begin to define ourselves in relation to them and the way they live. Burgess Walters wasn't one of those guys. He was, for all intents and purposes, a terrible human being. Fat, lethargic, carbuncular. It's appropriate, then, that Burgess was playing Falstaff to My Prince Hal in Henry IV, Part I. I was 25, and it was the first production I'd been in New York. I was the baby of the group, and they treated me as if I'd just gotten off the bus from Arkansas with nothing but a pair of tap shoes and a mayonnaise sandwich in my bags. My father had died about 6 months before, and I realize now that I felt short on mentors. I was looking for counsel, cosmic or otherwise, anywhere I could get it. You treat everybody like sons of bitches, you'll only be wrong about 2% of the time. This is one of Burgess's maxims. He had lots. He would go on and on about how, despite his looks, he possessed a pheromone, scientists were trying to pinpoint, that drove women wild. Despite only being in his early 40s at the time, he also seemed to be utterly falling apart. My ankle's turning over on itself on account of the rheumatoid. They want $16,000 to replace the thing. Hell, it's just a wooden block with a hinge. I got the money, but it's the principle of the thing. Burgess liked practical jokes. He was like my dad in this regard, dirty and playful and mischievous. On opening night, Burgess paid the rather comely woman who played Lady Percy $100 to tap me on the shoulder right before I made my first entrance in the play, her shirt raised, her breast out. "Do you like the way these rest on my rib cage?" she said. And then pushed me out on stage immediately. The result was me looking into the lights, dizzy, shell-shocked, the color leaving my face, and half muttering, "Thou art so fat-witted in drinking of old sack and unbuttoning thee after supper." This was the not-so-auspicious beginning of the production. Burgess played ringleader and head corrupter. Clever enough to improvise Shakespearean speech on the spot, he would insert new bits of dialogue into scenes with me. "I hath been like a sire to you, at least in terms of your mother being the mayor." Leaving me to either improvise myself or simply twist in the wind. Speaking of wind, another of Burgess's tactics was to fart, audibly or not, while performing a scene. He claimed, being Falstaff, that he finally had license. I complained to him about it one night early in the run of the show, which I quickly learned was the worst thing I could have done, because the next night, he was eating a series of bean tacos in the dressing room. Later, on stage, as he was giving a speech on honor, I could hear something seeping intermittently. "Can honor set to a leg? Or an arm?" And then a moment, and then it was just it wasn't just the worst smell an actor has ever created on stage. I firmly believe it was the worst smell anyone had ever created anywhere. It was like Satan's steamed broccoli. It was like green apples in perm. It was an assault to the nose. Yeah, but it actually seemed to burn you as it passed. The stench became like another character on stage with us, as if Hamlet's father appeared cloaked in a garment of stink. And the audience, oh, the audience, had they noticed? They had. Hundreds of squinting little eyes staring back, flinching. As the weeks went on, I realized that despite his many foibles, Burgess did have license. The man wasn't just born to play Falstaff, he was Falstaff. He was brilliant and repulsive and hilarious. And midway through the run, I began to not only like the guy, but understand why Prince Hal would want to spend all his time in the Boar's Head Tavern. The pleasures of the tavern, food and drink and sex and wit, are real pleasures. But more than that, more than the simple attraction to the base contagious clouds, we've all had friendships where nothing is sacred. Falstaff lives for pleasure. Pleasure is what brings about his relationship with Prince Hal and ultimately what destroys it. And Falstaff's seductive power is that he's free from the laws that govern the rest of us. It's the same irreverence for which people love my father. It was the same irreverence that built my strongest friendships. When I was around Burgess, there were no constraints or duties. How liberating is it not to care what anyone thinks? And if we can't be that person, if we don't have the strength or the gall, whichever it is, it's still a real charge to be with them. But what did they get out of it? What did the Falstaffs in all of our lives gain from debauching us? I'm reminded of a section of Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise where he talks about calories of virtue. Speaking to a girl, Amory Blaine says, "I have no more virtue to lose." Just as a cooling pot gives off heat, so all through youth and adolescence, we give off calories of virtue. That's why a good man going wrong attracts people. They stand around and literally warm themselves at the calories of virtue he gives off. In other words, once we've given off all our heat, there's nothing left to do but corrupt others and warm ourselves from them. This is why we're attracted to youth and beauty, not simply because we admire it, but because we want to corrupt it. In other words, the maiden doesn't want her virtue back to possess it, but to lose it all over again. I look back, and I've always had someone like this in my life. I've had a handful of friends in this Aristotelian sense of friendship that make me want to be a better person. But just as often, I've had mentors, be they peers or teachers or just clever libertines like Burgess, who showed me the joy of becoming worse. As the play went on, a mutual admiration grew between Burgess and I. He was a professional idler, yeah, but his talents didn't end with being able to drink me under the table. He could recite English and American poets like no one I'd ever seen, and he'd do it while he was rebuilding your carburetor, which was another gift he gave me. I remember that afternoon, hood open, he was submerged in grease and engine. I sat on the ground, leaning against the bumper, and apropos of nothing, he said the words, "I'm sorry to hear about your dad." He was older, right? I didn't know how he knew this, but this was right. My dad was in his 50s when he had me. Surprised and still reeling from his death, I couldn't really muster words at this. Burgess wiped his hands and sat down beside me. "My dad was old when he had me too," said Burgess. "Died when I was 20. When I was a little kid, I would pray every night that he would live until I was 18, because then I'd be an adult and I could handle it. I think I spent all those years afraid to get close to him because I knew he'd be gone too soon. And there it was. Burgess had articulated for me everything I'd felt about my relationship with my dad, but had never understood until that moment. More than that, though, he made me realize why I was there with him, why I'd always needed those supposedly corrupt men, these Falstaffs in my life, to take the place of the Falstaff who was gone.
Graham Gordy completed his MFA in dramatic writing at NYU, where he received the Goldberg Award for playwriting. His plays have been produced by Naked Angels, The New Group, New York Stage and Film, the Drama Department, and the Royal Court, London. His work has been published in the Oxford American, Arkansas Life, and he writes a column for the Arkansas Times. His TV pilot, The Wreck, was purchased by AMC. His screenplay, The Slow Rise of Wesley Sinker, is being produced by Anonymous Content, and he currently writes for the new Sundance series, Rectify. In our next story, best-selling author Trenton Lee Stewart takes us back to his high school, bursting with every kind of Shakespearean drama in Playing the Fool.
I wrote my first Shakespearean sonnet for an English class assignment when I was a high school student in Hot Springs, Arkansas. That was actually the perfect time to be writing Shakespearean sonnets, if you think about it. Because nothing is more Shakespearean than high school, where every emotion is writ large. In high school, the halls are bursting with every kind of drama, betrayals, romances, plots and schemes, fights aplenty. And the simplest of events can be as memorable and freighted with meaning as one of Shakespeare's immortal lines. Take, for example, my high school homecoming. Not even the game itself, with its obvious analogy to war, but the ceremony, which takes place in the gym after lunch while everyone is still digesting their corn dogs and half pints of milk. I saw a girl's heart get broken during that ceremony. And even before that, when I and a group of other students were decorating the gym, I learned something about myself that I've never forgotten. The backdrop had been set up and about 100 yards of crepe paper had been strung, and a few of the boys had gotten restless. One of them got into the coach's office and brought out a bunch of basketballs. Well, I hadn't played basketball since I was much younger and had never been any good anyway, so I was just as likely to make a shot from half court as I was to make a layup. Naturally, then, the first thing I did when a basketball bounced my way was to take it out to the half court line. I squared myself up, aimed for the top of the backboard, heaved the ball toward the rafters, and made the basket. You might think I walked off the court right then, leaving behind me a visible trail of cool. But what happened was this. A few of the other guys made a fuss about my shot. One of them tossed another ball to me. Meanwhile, some of the girls had started to pay attention. And among them was a particular girl I happened to have a crush on. Now, as of that moment, standing at the half-court line, preparing to take another shot. I had not yet written a sonnet for English class, but my circumstances couldn't have been more Shakespearean. In fact, at that moment, all of the following was true. My best friend was dating my ex-girlfriend, which would have caused me more consternation if I hadn't already found a new girlfriend. Even so, I had recently become infatuated with someone else, a girl named Kristen, and Kristen appeared to like me too. Yet not only did Kristen have a boyfriend, but she also had a crush on a friend of mine named Mike, who seemed to feel the same way about her. Since Mike was a good-looking football star, his interest in Kristen might have dashed my hopes, except for the fact that he had a girlfriend too. And so it went. If only one or two of us had been boys masquerading as girls, or vice versa, that Shakespeare play would have written itself. It was a Shakespearean sonnet I was supposed to be writing, though. Shakespearean sonnets, as you probably know, are often about love, sometimes about loving someone who may or may not love you back. So I had plenty of potential subjects. And one of them, Kristen, happened to be standing in the gym that day when I attempted my second half-court shot and almost made it. In fact, I came so close to making the shot, having just made my first attempt, you might think I was a natural. You might, if you were me, that is, begin excitedly to wonder if maybe you weren't born to make half-court shots. You might, if you were me, decide that the third time was absolutely going to be the charm. And so with everyone watching, including Kristen, the object of my infatuation, I dribbled the ball. I got set, I let fly, and I made it. So now the question becomes, what did I do next? And what does this have to do with that Shakespearean sonnet I had yet to write? Let me back up. A few years before, in junior high, I'd written a terrible and very long poem for a girl that included lines such as, "Why did God die on the cross?" And ended by asking her to be my girlfriend. I handed it to her outside the movie theater at the Hot Springs Mall just before my mom picked me up. I'm pretty sure our date had consisted of dinner at Orange Julius and a second viewing of Ghostbusters. Anyway, she agreed to be my girlfriend, but it was never meant to be. She's the one who dumped me and later started dating my best friend, a pole vaulter who knew better than to mess around with poetry. My point is that the boy standing out there on the basketball court was already familiar with extreme embarrassment. Both the humiliation of being dumped and the almost instantaneous shaming regret at having written and shared such an awful poem, never to be reclaimed or unwritten. A poem whose title might as well have been, "I am so awkward and vulnerable, it defies belief, so here's proof for the ages. Now go ahead and destroy me." But what did this boy do? This boy who had just made 2 out of 3 half-court shots, who in other words had already pushed his luck so far that there was no possible way of its ever returning. What did he do? He pushed it further. I took another shot, and another, and another. By the time I left the gym that day, I'd made at least a couple dozen attempts. But after those first two, I never made another basket. The others lost interest. People either began taking their own shots or else returned to the important work of decorating. And I had to pretend that I was just fooling around, that I had always been just fooling around, that certainly I never expected anyone to think that I had some special talent on the basketball court. And later, during the homecoming ceremony, I watched as my friend Mike set the crown on the head of the homecoming queen. It was Kristen. And as was the custom, kiss her. It was no small kiss, either. It was a long kiss, long enough to break the heart of his girlfriend who sat in the bleachers watching. And Kristen kissed him back. But this is Shakespeare. This is high school. By the end of the play, despite everything that's come before, I've written my Shakespearean sonnet, a terrible poem riven with the agonies of impossible love. So has Kristen. So have we all. And before the curtain closes, despite my failings on the basketball court, I will actually date Kristen for a while, but it won't work out. Neither will it work out for my ex-girlfriend and my best friend, nor for Mike and the girl whose heart he broke that day. We all play our roles, never sure whether we are starring in a comedy or tragedy, never sure when we are playing the fool. In this way, being in high school really is more like watching a Shakespeare play. On some profound level, you feel all the drama and comedy and excitement and import, but half the time you don't know what the hell is going on. I have no idea what became of that Shakespearean sonnet I wrote in high school. Vanity makes me hope that it's lost to the ages. But really, it doesn't matter if it is, because even though we wear different clothes now and have jobs and children and responsibilities, even though we try, sometimes with success, to behave more sensibly, in some of the most important ways, we are still high schoolers even now. Even now, we are all of us writing Shakespeare every day with our lives.
Trenton Lee Stewart is author of the novel Flood Summer and the best-selling Mysterious Benedict Society series. His newest book, The Extraordinary Education of Nicholas Benedict, will be published in April by Little Brown Books for Young Readers. He lives in Little Rock with his wife and two sons. In our final story of the night, Oxford American publisher Warwick Sabin begins to see that the bard is more familiar than he ever imagined in Billy Shakespeare.
I'm sitting at my desk at the Oxford American Magazine's offices in downtown Little Rock when the phone rings, shattering the quiet. It is Mary Ruth with the Arkansas Shakespeare Theater inviting me to speak at their annual fundraising event about the bard himself. No way, I think, as I try to beg out of it. That is a subject I am definitely not qualified to address, especially on a program with a Hollywood producer, award-winning writers, English professors, and other Shakespeare experts. I'm just the publisher of a Southern literary magazine. But Mary Ruth is persuasive, so I tell her I will think about it and get back with her. And I hang up the phone thinking, what have I done? But then I start spending some time investigating the biography of this guy named Shakespeare. And as I start to look a little more closely at the bard, I gain some confidence. After all, if you leave out most of the particulars, you're left with a boy named Billy, who was bored living in his little rural town. He knocked up his girlfriend before he was 18, so he had to get married, and then he had a couple more kids. It wasn't long before he left them behind to run off to the big city to chase his dreams in the entertainment industry. So at the very least, you have the beginnings of a serviceable country music song. Now, I'm not saying that Shakespeare was actually Southern. That's obviously just silly. But if you think about what makes his work unique, you begin to see how his legacy is best reflected in works that come from the South. Other forms of American literature are too earnest or straightforward. Russian literature is unmitigated pain and tragedy, while the French do better with romance and comedy. The Germans take themselves too seriously, and even British literature after Shakespeare is a little too cool and reasonable. The true inheritors of Shakespeare's mantle are Southern. Robert Penn Warren, William Faulkner, Walker Percy, Flannery O'Connor, Mark Twain, and especially Tennessee Williams. These writers capture all of life's nuances and subtleties in ways that are both believable and ridiculous, and most of the time believable because they are ridiculous. In essence, they find the comedy in tragedy, find the tragedy in romance, find the romance in the pedestrian, find what is pedestrian among the powerful, uncover what is powerful among the fools, demonstrate how the fools can uncover wisdom, find the wisdom in irony and contradiction, and turn the irony and contradiction back into comedy. In other words, they chart the full circle of human experience. Consider the characters we meet in Shakespeare. There are drunks, rogues, and harlots, corrupt politicians, and a constant parade of innocent and naive young people who are always carnally motivated while professing only a religious devotion to piety and love. All of that sounds pretty Southern to me. There is no doubt that the echoes of Shakespeare can be found in Southern literary characters and vice versa. Others have noticed the presence of Macbeth in The Sound and the Fury and Absalom, Absalom. The Southern concept of honor is taken to its extreme by Hotspur. Furthermore, almost any Shakespeare play can be given a Southern twist, even A Midsummer Night's Dream. In 2008, the Tennessee Shakespeare Theater staged a production in which, according to a news article, quote, the king and queen of fairies are actually a couple who died in the Civil War, and the other sprites are the ghosts of children, orphans and runaways who also died during that time. In fact, the structure of Elizabethan England was a lot like the South, with its hierarchical society and plantation economy. Still, what is interesting about Shakespeare is that he did not always set his plays in England. Aside from his histories, he placed his characters in foreign locales. And since he had never traveled outside of the country, he conjured everything from his imagination. And sometimes it seems as though he was imagining the South. Take the very beginning of Twelfth Night, for example. In the first lines of the play, Duke Orsino says, If music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it, that, surfeiting, the appetite may sicken and so die. That strain again, it had a dying fall. And he goes on a little while longer, and then Curio answers him, will you go hunt, my lord? So there, at the start of the play, Shakespeare includes all of the basic touchstones of Southern culture. Music, food, and hunting. It's as if he had us in mind. But the real evidence of Shakespeare's Southern predilections is exposed in an unlikely place, Antony and Cleopatra. Take these lines by Cleopatra in Act 2, Scene 5. Give me some music, music moody food of us that trade in love. Let it alone, let's to billiards, come, Charmian. And when goodwill is showed, though it come too short, the actor may plead pardon. I'll none now, give me mine angle, will to the river. There, my music playing far off, I will betray tawny finned fishes. My bended hook shall pierce their slimy jaws. And as I draw them up, I think them every one an Antony, and say, aha, you're caught. Then Charmian says, 'Twas merry when you wagered on your angling, when your diver did hang a salt fish on his hook, which he with fervency drew up. And Cleopatra responds, that time, oh times, I laughed him out of patience, and that night I laughed him into patience, and next morn, ere the ninth hour, I drunk him to bed, then put my tires and mantles upon him whilst I wore his sword, Philippin. And there you have it. I sit back in my chair and breathe a sigh of relief, because it's at that moment that I realize that we know this Billy, and he knew us. In just a few lines, we're introduced to a sex-starved woman who likes good music and food, who plays pool and gambles, who fishes and drinks, and who knows her way around tires. I rest my case, and I dial Mary Ruth. Thank you very much.
Warwick Sabin is publisher of the Oxford American Magazine, a national magazine based here in Arkansas, dedicated to featuring the very best in Southern writing while documenting the complexity and vitality of the American South. Billed as the Southern Magazine of Good Writing, it has won 3 national magazine awards and other high honors since it began publication in 1992. The New York Times has said that the Oxford American may be the liveliest literary magazine in America. Warwick holds degrees from the University of Arkansas and Oxford University, and in 2009, he was named to the Folio 40, a list of the 40 most influential people in the national magazine industry. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? What y'all think? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is in partnership with the Arkansas Shakespeare Theater. You can find out more about them and the annual Bard Ball on March 10, 2012 at arcshakes.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.